Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hi folks, welcome to another one of our political chats. I'm joined by Dan. And today we're going to be talking about the liminal moment that I think Britain has found itself in. So you may have heard the term liminal space. Well, liminal means the point of the threshold at which something is going to change. Yeah. So we are, I think, moving into something new here, actually. But I don't think the thing that we're moving into is what they think it's going to be. And I think it's actually a good thing that we get this done now.
You're going to have to sell me on this case because my sort of view has been that nothing will change.
Yeah. Well, okay, well, let's talk about Andy Burnham. Right. So he came out and gave what is essentially his pitch to make me Prime Minister to the Labour Party, to coronate him, as they've been saying. And I think this is actually good. Now, I realise not that the pitch itself is good.
Right.
Actually, the pitch itself is actually not that bad, right? But I think this is good.
Well, is there anything to the pitch beyond I'm not Keir Starmer?
Yeah, yeah, there is actually.
Okay.
It's a positive pitch. Right. Right? It's actually not just a negative pitch. Unlike Farage's pitches are always just,
yes,
stop that guy.
Yes.
Yeah, but why you? But no, there is something to this, right? Because I actually think that getting Andy Burnham out of the way now is much better, because we've talked about the factions in Labour and how they have their leaders, right? Keir Starmer is the leader of the managerial technocracy, the Southern London human rights lawyers. Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the hard left, and both of these factions have failed. Well, what have we actually got left? We've got the trade unions and the soft left.
Now, yeah.
The trade unions aren't going to bring, I don't think they're going to bring forth a champion, because they're not an electoral force, right? The trade unions are an industrial force that are used to operating in negotiations behind the scenes.
I mean, they did. Ed Miliband, a few years ago, he was essentially their champion. He got elected Labour because he was the union pick.
Can you imagine Ed Miliband being the front and centre vote for Ed Miliband?
Well, I mean, they tried it and it was disastrous. Yes.
It never was. Yeah. So I think this is essentially what Andy Burnham represents, I think, is probably the last constituency in the coalition of the Labour Party. So if Andy Burnham fails, then that's every group in the Labour Party that has been brought forth and screwed it up. So anything they produce now will just be more of the same. Everyone will be like, oh yeah, I've heard that before. You know, if we get another human rights lawyer, we'll be like, oh, it's going to be another Keir Starmer. If we get another hard left guy, it's going to be, oh, it's another Jeremy Corbyn. And after Andy Burnham, it'll be, oh, it'll just be another Andy Burnham, right? Mm. And so getting this out of the way now, rather than having it be the new thing in 2029, is good. And I don't think it matters that much whether he calls a general election or not. I don't think he's going to, because I don't think they can be sure that they're going to win. Like, he ran in Makerfield because he knew he was going to win.
Yeah, I think he has the option, because his level of support within the Labour Party is so high that if he had won Makerfield in a very marginal way, then people would have said, well, look, I'm only going to support you for leader if you can guarantee my seat is going to be safe. But because it's so overwhelmingly going to be him, he's got the political capital within the Labour Party to do it. However, because all of these people think that it's a personality issue, the machine doesn't work because the personality at the top, and they all think this, all the Tories, all the Labour Party, they all think you just swap out the personality at the top.
And just to be clear, this is expressly Burnham's opinion as well.
Yes.
Oh, yes. It's expressly his opinion.
Yeah, they all think it.
I'm going to do things differently.
Including Andy
Burnham. Bloody not, Mr. Yeah. Burnham.
They genuinely think that all you need to do is sit on top of the machine and give different instructions. Because, for example, he's been talking about we need to build more houses. And he actually thinks that you just tell the machine, you just tell your civil servants, okay, let's build more houses, and then it happens. No, the machine outputs what the machine outputs, and the machine can't be changed, because at this level, there's so many competing tensions within it that if you try and change the machine in any way, it all breaks apart.
I mean,
so the machine isn't going to do anything.
Pausing on that point, the machine could be changed, but you would essentially be committing, as you say, to junking the whole thing.
You'd have to go into it knowing that you're seriously going to upset people, and there's going to be enormous institutional pushback.
And fundamentally, it's Labour's machine.
Yes.
Like he's doing everything he's doing. He was very clear in the make of the election. I'm here to save the Labour Party. And that means save the entire project of what Labour has been doing. He doesn't, I mean, he was part of Blair's Labour government, right?
Yes.
He doesn't see himself as separate to this. He sees this as what the Labour Party should be doing. Mm. And therefore, he's not going to go like, right, okay, the system needs to be junked in the way that, say, Nigel Farage or Rupert Lowe would. And, you know, the Conservatives are obviously on the Keep Blair's system plantation. But at least Farage and Lowe would be like, yeah, no, this, I mean, being most charitable to Farage, not that I think he's actually going to do it, but if Farage could at least go, well, I think the system is wrong and I want to change it.
Farage at least recognised that the system was not built for him.
Yes.
Whereas Keir Starmer, the system was built for exactly somebody like him. Yes. And even he started complaining a few months in.
Yes.
But I asked for things to be done and nothing happens.
And Andy Burnham is going to discover that the system is also not built for him.
Mm.
That's the thing, because the soft left are still sentimentally connected to their roots in the north. They still think of themselves as working class, white working class northern communities. And so you'll notice that Andy Burnham's rhetoric, he never focuses on identity politics. He never focuses on minorities. It's actually a very parochial, tribal. I mean, his Makefield pitch was for us, yes, in a 97% white English seat.
Well, he kind of does have identity politics, but the identity is Labour.
Sure, yeah, yeah, okay. What I mean is racial difference.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Right. He's never promising to the minority groups, I'm going to make Britain brilliant for you. That's Keir Starmer's human rights lawyers talking.
Yes. Right?
That's the rhetoric they use. Oh, no, he's saying, no, it's for us, for the northern Manchester white working class. This is expressed.
But he's not going to go after the bit of the Home Office which is trying to maximise the amount of Muslims coming in.
Obviously not. Obviously not. Obviously. But the point is, you can see him where he locates his personal identity.
His lodestar, yeah. It's,
yeah, exactly.
Pointing in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, exactly. But the system is not built for them. So he will come into contact with the system and be like, right, so I can't do anything about this. And I'll be like, no, because there are all these laws, all these rules, that all these legal challenges will be triggered by the lefty human rights lawyers that you endorse in every other way. You just don't want them in charge of the Labour Party because they're destroying your party. And so he will find himself, as you say, sat at the top of the machine he can't control.
He can put a different gloss on it. That's about the only thing he can do.
Yep, and he will, and he has. Yep. And in fact, in his defence, like, for Labour's last best hope, he's not bad, right? He's actually, he's not an unlikable guy. He seems on a personal level to be someone you could, you know, have a nice chat with the pub in, right?
Yes.
And he seems to actually care about the people of the North.
Yes.
Right? He's made this promise to them that, as we discussed last time, no, I'm here to save the Labour Party for us, so that we can go back to our ancestral roots of being serfs on the Labour plantation.
Yeah, you feel like with this guy, you could have a pint with him and you might not agree with his politics, but you could have a bit of banter about something. Whereas Keir Starmer, you kind of think, if I went on a camping trip with this guy and fell asleep, I'd wake up tied up and he'd be skinning me.
yeah, that's basically,
yes,
that's basically the difference. So he has actually got a good gloss to put on the Labour Party.
Mm.
And actually, his recommendations are not bad recommendations, right? So we'll go through the Burnham blueprint, because Andy Burnham,
all based on the assumption that he can actually do any of this.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
The intentionality,
yes,
is not terrible, right? It doesn't solve all the problems, but it does recognize and attempt to address some of the attacks that are coming from the right, right?
Yes.
And not the important ones, but we'll get to
it. It's just that I look at this stuff now, when a prime minister comes in and says that he wants to do something, I look at it the way that people used to look at 30 years ago when Miss World used to come out and say, I want world peace. It's like, you just like, yes, dear.
So do I. Yeah, yeah, so do I. Anyway, so let's go through just the main points, right, as given us by the Guardian. So devolution. Now, this is one of those things that sounds nice to the soft left, because it's like, oh yeah, local power for local people. It's like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. But what that also means is the system more fully entrenching itself with layers of bureaucracy and middling sort of politicians who've got a very small stake, a very large stake in a very small pond. And so, I mean, like, who gives a damn what happens in the Welsh Assembly? Nobody other than the people in the Welsh Assembly.
So I would be absolutely in favour of devolution if you devolved everything, including taxation.
Yeah, if taxation were included,
yes,
right? Oh, that'd be a great idea.
Yes.
But then you don't have a unitary state anymore, really.
No. Well, that's kind of what I want.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'd like the Parliament in Wessex and Winchester.
Yes.
If we could get elected to the Parliament in Winchester and have taxation set by Wessex, and you could have Mercia and Northumbria and all that.
At least what the Americans have for states, but more so.
Yeah.
All it is an extra body that can borrow money.
Yes, exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. And can bring in extra regulations to make your life worse, but can never repeal necessary regulations that could make your life better. Right, so it will never be useful to us, but it sounds like a good idea from his perspective because of the sort of like dreamy, oh, isn't it just good to devolve powers without devolving taxation?
Mm.
But what that also means is it cements the system, right? Mm. Because now, rather than having you had like constituency countries like England doesn't have it, but Northern Ireland, Wales, and Scotland, you could see how a sort of revolutionary fervor could build up in that size of a national block, right? Mm. But if you had like a parliament for Yorkshire, a parliament for Mercia, a parliament for Wessex, that's not enough, right? And especially if they have no taxational powers or anything like that, or very limited executive powers, it means that the system, they're always going to just do what the parliament in Westminster always did with the EU, just kick it up. Got a problem. Well, that's Westminster. Like they say, that's the EU. The EU's making us do this. Power out of our hands. We don't have to think very hard about this. We don't have to take responsibility for anything, but we continue to draw salaries and we continue to impose ridiculous rules on you because we're bored, frankly, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so this is just a way of the system just making itself more Byzantine, more complex, more elaborate, and
it's just extra layers.
It's just extra layers. Makes it more difficult to shift.
Yes.
So boring, not useful, but I suppose to be expected. And then reform of Westminster and Whitehall. Now, this is
just like every other prime minister thinks they're going to reform Whitehall.
Yeah, exactly. That's what Keir Starmer said. Like, that's literally what Keir Starmer said. I'm going to fix Westminster. No one's going to fix it, right? But the interesting thing he does have here is that backbenchers should be empowered to act to change things in their local areas and promised that he wouldn't use the whip system to create for a closed-down debate, though he stopped short of promising to abolish it. Because, of course, the whip system, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a powerful way of parties to make sure their MPs vote in the right way on hot-button issues.
Very, very quickly on that, you get your order paper, which is the business of the day.
Yep.
You get your votes and they either unline them one, two or three times. Three lines basically means you will be kicked out of the party if you don't vote for this. Two lines is you better vote for it, but if you're literally dying, then maybe we'll let you off. Yep. And one line is if you can be bothered, turn up and vote.
Yeah.
And what will happen is he's saying this now. The moment it's a vote that he actually cares about, it'll be three-line whips all over the place.
Exactly. This is why he's not abolishing it. But giving backbenchers the power to do things in their local constituency actually might be useful, because as you've spoken about before, the real power of an MP is in representation and patronage, getting people to do things in your local area. Because an MP actually has zero executive power in their own location. It's all council members.
Oh, they don't have any executive power.
Yeah, none. Yeah. Zero. Literally nothing. So, it sounds like the most blue-ball job in the world, frankly. So I've been elected an MP. What does that mean? Well, everyone feels it's important. What can you do? Nothing.
Yeah. All MPs can do is basically hope to be selected for the executive.
Yeah.
And which is why I prefer the American system on this, because they separate the legislative from the executive,
yes,
which we don't do.
No. And, I suppose there's probably a bit of a sway if... I just read Jess Phillips' book on being an MP.
Good God.
Honestly, it wasn't that bad. It was,
Right. Are you in it?
No, I'm not.
Right.
I didn't think I was. which is a surprise, actually. But she says, look, a lot of it is just... essentially being a go-between between the public and the services that the government provides. So if a local council hasn't picked up rubbish in this area, she then gets onto the local council to pick up the rubbish or her stuff.
Yeah, it's a social worker.
It's literally just a glorified babysitter, basically. So actually that's not a bad idea, and it might mean that there's something in being a politician, right? There's actually like... a measure of responsibility. You actually get to change something, and therefore it's worthwhile being a politician, which might incentivize actually decent people to become politicians, right? Who knows? Who knows, right? But the point is, he's not gonna significantly reform Westminster, I don't think. And even if he does reform Westminster in any particular way, I don't think it's gonna change all that much. And like you said, the second he needs it, the whip will come back and everything will return. Business as
usual. In an instant. Yep.
So an end of trickle down economics. Well, we've heard this before as well. Rachel Reeves has said exactly this, but it's like, okay. It's just trickle down from the government now rather than from private industry.
That's all we have. Except the trickle down is from the government and then out into the welfare system. That is literally all we have at this point.
Yes. So, you know, like, oh yeah, well, you know, we'll do that. It's like, okay, great. But again, Burnham is completely hamstrung here in the fact that he's not going to have any fiscal headroom. He hasn't got like a big war chest that's just sat in the treasury.
No, he's 132 billion in the hole every year.
Exactly. Yeah, we spend more in benefits than we take in personal taxes, for example. Right. So he's inheriting a tragic economy that is on his last legs and can't go on forever, and he is not going to be able to do anything with it. So he's like, oh yeah, I'd like to expand the role of the state in running essential services, housing, and industrial strategy. Okay, with what money?
How are you going to pay for that then?
Yeah, exactly. What are you going to do?
Because his whole experience in Manchester is like I said, it's just a body that can borrow money.
Yeah.
So all he had to do whenever he wanted to do something in Manchester was just ring up the Treasury. Yeah. You literally, as a local authority, you just ring up the Treasury and say, I want some money. And you tell them how much money you want, and they will deposit it into your account. And then you pay the Bank of England rate plus a quarter.
And then you say, I hate the bond market, so it's more difficult to borrow that money.
But it's you can do it at a local authority level because the scale of the borrowing is so low compared to the UK that you can get away with it. But when you're in the top job, the bond markets are already maxed out the amount where they're willing to lend at this current rate.
And if you're Keir Starmer and you're seen as being someone who understands that business is important, fine. If you're Andy Burnham and have got a public track record of saying, I hate the bond markets, I don't think we should be paying attention. The bond markets are holding us down there and chaining, you know. Yeah. It's like, no.
Stop asking for money then.
Yeah, it's a bank, basically. Yes. You know, you're just borrowing money from a bank, Andy. You're not enslaved by them. But anyway, the point is, they're not exactly his best friend. And so, okay, and again, one of the things about Andy Burnham is there is no clear policies, right?
Oh, no.
There is no clear... He states a direction of travel, but he doesn't give you anything that's...
I've heard ambitions. Yeah. I've heard wishes.
Yes.
I haven't heard any policy yet.
Again, very much like Miss World being like, oh, I'd like world peace. Yeah, wouldn't we all? But anyway, so we don't know, but he's basically going to do more of the same, probably further, in the belief that this will one day produce economic prosperity. Obviously, he's not going to.
Yes.
Anyway, so he wants to take the utilities back into national ownership, which I do actually approve of.
I don't especially hate this.
No, why do we let... For different reasons. Mine for xenophobic reasons. Why do foreigners own our utilities?
Yeah.
Why did we allow the Conservatives to sell off the utilities to their buddies and make a cut on them?
The only thing I would say is that... even though it doesn't really make sense to have utilities in private ownership, is that they required huge subsidies when they were in public ownership. Sure. And when they were privatised, they actually started paying taxes. So they are significantly more effective in private hands.
Sure.
It's just that...
The price of them has been rocketing.
Well, that is true, but...
I would rather publicly subsidise the utilities and have my taxes keep my water rates down.
You do get a lot of bloat, though. So
I'm not saying you don't, and I appreciate it's, you know, there's no easy answer and there's no correct answer to it. But we've had decades of privatization, and Thames Water is, like, for example, Thames Water's bankrupt and it's constantly leaking. I can't remember how much it was. My wife told me the other day that it was an unbelievable amount of water is just wasted by Thames Water because it's just not worth paying to repair it. Right. And it's like, okay, well, you know, same with the trains. The trains are constantly terrible because it's not worth paying to upgrade them. And it's, okay, well, I would rather the government actually give us good infrastructure that we're paying through the nose for. At least the infrastructure would be good, right? At least it can say, oh, I'm building this thing because, you know, like trains with aircon on, for example, right? In the current heat wave. No, I'm not even joking. I went down to London to the art conference. Crap, by the way. And a bunch of the trains were cancelled. During the middle of the day, they're just cancelled. Aircon not good enough. I got on a train, waiting half an hour. They're like, "Yeah, sorry, we're going to have to cancel this train because the aircon's not good enough." It's like, oh my God, we'd be halfway home by now if you'd just gone. But instead, they waited for half an hour, hoping that the temperature on the train would go down. And basically, we had to change two trains to get on one that had half decent aircon. But even then, he was like, on the third carriage, the aircon isn't working, so go on the other carriages. And obviously, everything's completely packed. So yeah. It's like, there's no room on the other carriage. Anyway, the point being, it's not working in private hands either, right? So
yeah,
the system...
Right, I think the only way it's going to work is if you get the Japanese to run it.
Basically.
Their trains are amazing.
No doubt. But the point is, Thames Water is actually not a bad case to use. They've gone bankrupt. Mm. The question is the government just going to like take on their assets and whatnot, or are their bondholders take over, blah, blah, blah. I actually don't see why we're subsidising cheap infrastructure in Europe by allowing them to own our infrastructure. Mm. So anyway, moving on. Social housing. Oh, my goodness.
Yep. Good luck.
I mean, it's just... He's just... he's literally said, oh, the problem...
There is a really easy way to fix the problem with social housing.
Yeah, stop importing people.
Yes. Well, and kick out the people who are
not native
in social housing, and suddenly you get millions of them back.
I mean, that literally would...
Yes.
Unlock millions of houses.
Yes.
But he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't ever talk about immigration. That's something... And there's this general attitude on the left that they understand that they've lost the argument on immigration and can never contest it. So they don't. Right? They just don't. Keir Starmer's the closest, saying, look, we reduced net immigration to only 150 or 250,000 or whatever it is. It's like, Keir, that's still awful. Yes. That was awful when everyone was like, God, immigration's awful.
Yes.
But then Boris Johnson made it so much worse. And you're like, yeah, I've got it back down to awful levels. So, oh, brilliant. You know, anyway, the point being, he's just like, yeah, we're just going to have to concrete over the green and pleasant land we live in so we can live in Mega City 1 full of Somalians and whoever else.
Splendid.
Yeah, wonderful. So their target is to build 1.5 million new homes, which is not going to happen because, of course, the reason they don't just build rampantly already is regulations and overbearing government and like various like legal nonsense. Like, look at HS2.
Well, I've got a good example of this. I did a Brokenomics on house prices people can go and watch, and I got a couple of housing developers to come in. And I mean, just one example, at one point they had to stop for a week so that inspectors could come and stand there at night and count the number of bats with a
tick. I knew you were going to say bats.
And that's one example, but it's not like it's that. Yeah. It's thousands of things like that where they just stop for some stupid bureaucratic process.
I mean, there's a reason that HS2 has cost like 200 million before even breaking ground. You know, it's just like, oh, why? Oh, we've got to check fish population. Oh, no, that was a nuclear power plant to do the fish disco with.
It'd be some nonsense.
Yeah, absolute nonsense. Right? So, look, just build. Anyway, the point is, they're not going to. He's not going to repeal the laws.
That is another Miss World speech, that one.
100%. Yeah. 100%. Then he's going to fix the high streets. And so, how are you going to do
this? Well, hopefully the same way I proposed fixing the housing problem. How is he going to do it, though?
Well, I mean, he recognises that these have become a key political background, with reform highlighting boarded-up shops, a symbol of the economic mismanagement of Labour and the Tories. But, okay, Burnham's plan is to, quote, reform business rates. Now, if that means abolishing business rates...
And that will actually work.
That would actually work.
Yes.
The reason that the high streets have turned into vape shops, barbers, and American candy shops, and various other and the new one is the Bangladeshi luggage shops. You notice them around.
Yes.
Right? The reason that they exist is because these people don't pay the business rates, because they liquidate their companies every year and just start a new company.
Yeah, and they don't even bother to change the signage when they do that.
They don't. Yeah, exactly. They don't change the signage. They don't pay taxes. They don't pay the business rates. They don't file tax returns at company's house or anything like that. They just liquidate, create a new company, and it's literally every year.
Because they know... I mean, if you or I made an error on our taxes, a good faith error, HMRC would be all over us. Yeah, but you can literally have a shop in the high street and pay no taxes, no business rate, and they will never go after you because, oh, we don't want to appear racist.
But even if they do, it's like, okay, well, how long can you drag that out for, right? Mm. And administratively, you can drag it out for years, right? Like, okay, the council sends you a letter and you don't reply for 6 months. They send you another letter. You don't reply for another 6 months. And then they send you a final demand. Oh, no, okay, I will reply to that one. And they'll say, can you provide this, this, and this in 3 months? And you'll drag it out. And then in 6 months, they'll say, you haven't provided this, blah, 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 blah. And so like 2 years down the line, they're like, right, we're going to begin legal action against you and we're going to seize your property. Oh, we're going to dissolve our business.
Yep.
What are you going to seize now? Nothing. Oh, I just happened to have reincorporated another business on exactly the same plot of land in exactly the same building.
Same staff, same signage, same products.
See, exactly.
Same owners.
And, you know,
but it's a new company.
But yeah. Exactly. So now they have to go through the process again. And it's like, oh my God. You know, so these people basically don't have to pay the business rates and everything else. And everyone else has been hamstrung by it. So the only things you see in the high street, the only things that can actually work are companies that are committing crimes by just existing. So it's just like, right, okay. If reform the business rates means just get rid of them, which you should because it's just robbery, brilliant. Then we can compete because then suddenly we're all on the same level again and people would rather come to us or whatever, you know, shops than go to the bloody barbers. But that's literally the reason. So anyway, the next thing is reindustrialization. Now, again, no clear plan here, but just this is very much a Miss World wish list. Burnham said he would safeguard sovereign manufacturing and production capability across the country in critical sectors like steel, defence, energy, food and farming. I mean, good idea.
So literally all you need to do is fire Ed Miliband into the sea and get somebody who can make energy as cheap as possible.
Yep.
And then all of that stuff that he said there will just appear.
Well, kind of. Because, I mean, like, how are you going to prevent the Chinese from flooding the market with cheap steel?
Yeah. I mean, they've got cheap energy and cheap workers.
Yes, they do. Cheap workers, cheap energy, and an abundance of iron. So what's the plan? Well, you're going to have to tariff them, right? So suddenly you're actually playing a much more aggressive game in international trade. But that's going to have knock-on effects. There are going to be native businesses that needed that steel or whatever it is, you know, food or whatever it is.
Yep.
All the native businesses are going to be like, okay, well, we need other things, and this is going to raise prices. And I'm sure that we'll get to the cost of living a little bit later.
Just quickly, on we're doing it on farming,
yep.
where we set extraordinary farming regulations for native farmers,
yes.
But we don't tariff farm goods from anywhere else. So they just ignore all of that stuff, say that they've done it, import it in, and then our farmers can't compete.
A great example of this is in Wales. I think it was 10% of the farmland has to be rewilded. So every farm in Wales, this is what the local government in Wales has done, has made it so by law in Wales, you have to fallow 10% of your land. You just can't use it. So you're at 90% maximum capacity anyway. And then you've got whatever, like, you know, I don't know how farming works, but you've got to leave certain fields fallow for certain periods of time and stuff like this. And so you're never getting 100% anyway, but you're already cut down by 10% before you even begin. And that's without all of the taxes, all of the other regulations, all of the, like, whatever the bloody needs.
And a local authority cannot imagine why that'd be a problem, because for them, getting to 90% capacity would be an enormous leap in productivity.
Yeah, it would. But then, as you said, all of these people in all the other countries basically living in like a narco state, yep. where like what does central government look like in Peru if you're a Peruvian agriculturalist, yep. you know, or in bloody South Africa or wherever, you know.
We don't even need to go that far. I mean, Poland doesn't do all the bollocks we do with farming.
So yeah. It's just so much easier for them to just, oh, we'll just import a billion tons of it by cargo container.
Yep.
And then our farmers, of course, get squeezed. And then you've got the government's like, oh, we're going to put an inheritance tax on your farms and all this sort of stuff. So it's just like, right. I mean, I'm in favor of this kind of national economic strategy, this nationalist economic strategy. But I don't think for a second that Burnham has the balls to go and do what you actually need to do.
No.
Right? He hasn't got the balls.
No, he'll just do speeches.
He'll vibes, wishes, and, you know. But again, it's another issue seized by Nigel Farage. So he's trying to pip Nigel Farage off the post here. He's not going to do anything on this, obviously. But then we go to education and employment. And again, we need to complete rethink of how we support the next generation to succeed. It has to start with the education system. Okay.
Right.
So what does that mean? Well, that just means getting people to do technical colleges rather than academic education. So, okay, you're going to get apprenticeships rather than degrees. Okay, great, Andy. But that's actually not the sum total of the problem with the education system. The problem with the education system is, like, if all of our students were coming out of the education system sounding like, Enoch Powell would be a good example. You know, someone who's very articulate. So coming out like T.S. Eliot, right? Coming out sounding like the average person from the 1950s sounded, you know, smart, articulate, able to form arguments, able to critically examine information they were given, then I wouldn't even be coming out. Yeah, okay, well, they've all got to go on degrees. That's not great. But at least that we're producing very intelligent, very capable young people through the education. No, the problem with the education system, which the classical education system.
Indoctrination.
It's crap.
Yeah.
It's not even that it's indoctrination. It's crap. Like, yes. People are coming out thick. Half of them unable to bloody read and write. No attention spans. All this sort of thing. Right? It's not what they're being taught. It's how they are being taught that is actually the problem. And so don't get me wrong. I'm in favor of bringing back, you know, apprenticeships and all this sort of stuff. But it's the nature of the system that is not competitive and has low standards that is the issue. And of course, he doesn't talk about any of that, obviously. And this is, you know, so we're just going to produce people with a low education who now work with their hands rather than work with their minds. So, okay, brilliant.
Yep.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So anyway, we get to the cost of living. The Guardian hits you there. It's unclear what form these measures will take. He doesn't know.
He hasn't got a clue.
Burnham has hinted he'll look at tax cuts. I mean, bravo, I would love tax cuts. But he doesn't know what he's going to do because he's got the problem that the system is the system.
Yeah.
Like, as we've covered, like, okay, you want to have high tariffs protecting British industries. Well, how are you going? That's going to...
But also, he wants to free himself of the bond market, and the only way that... Well, he can cut spending, but he's not going to.
Sure, he could.
So the only thing he's realistically going to do is just print the money instead, which is going to cause the cost of living to go up.
Well, let's get to the fiscal rules.
All right.
Because, as you can see, the biggest challenge for Burnham, as for successive prime ministers, will be how to pay for his plans.
Yep.
The role of Chancellor is still undecided. I'm hoping Ed Miliband... I want Ed Miliband failing upwards, right? Obviously, because I'm an accelerationist. But as you can see, they sending a clear signal to jittery bond investors, he's pledged his policy agenda would be backed with sound public finances and the discipline of our current fiscal rules. So he is going to, as he says, retain the self-imposed borrowing and debt constraints drawn up by Rachel Reeves to limit his options. But this is the reason why they can't get anything done either. This is the reason why the only option is raise taxes.
Yep. Well, they've run out of money and, yeah, and they can't borrow anymore.
Yes. So, in summary, right, these things are deliberately done to address many of the issues that Farage is raising. Now, the primary issue that plagues this country, you'll notice, wasn't on this list.
No, it wasn't.
He didn't mention immigration at all.
No, we mentioned it, but no, they didn't mention it, no.
No. So, no matter what happens, Burnham is wearing these blinkers.
Yes.
The real problem will forever be outside of his peripheral vision, but he'll focus on trying to get the machine, as you said, to do things it's not going to do. Mm. He's not going to have the bravery to actually junk the machine and build a new one, which is what actually needs to happen. So, nothing's going to happen as he studiously avoids the problem, right? All that will happen is things will get worse, your taxes will go up, there will be more immigrants on your high street, and the cost of everything around you will go up. That's all that's going to happen. Eat all the goodwill in the world is not going to fix this. Am I wrong?
No. No. But what is their line on immigration? I mean, it used to be for years that it makes us stronger and it improves the economy, but since that has been so comprehensively debunked.
Well, prior to this speech, he did say that he was going to keep Shabana Mahmood's immigration reforms, which, to her credit, have lowered the net immigration. Right now, that still means that 850,000 migrants a year are let in, which is what last year's figures were. But to her credit, that is lower than the Boris Wave record of about 1.5 million. So, I mean, it's a low bar to cross, but she did cross it. But the weird thing is, we're in the last days of the Starmer regime, and Morgoth DM'd me the day, so it really seems like Starmer's holding a lot of this back, because Shabana Mahmood has decided, no, we're actually always going to offer sanctuary to those fleeing war and persecution, and that means literally anyone. Applications for new, capped, and safe legal routes will be opened in autumn based on the Canadian community sponsorship model.
Well, if they focus on war zones, the most horrific and long-lasting war zone that immediately pops to mind is Sudan.
Ukraine.
Oh, Sudan is worse and has been going on longer, but
not that much longer.
But that was a Sudanese guy who chopped up that chap in Belfast.
Well, yeah, but this is pretty pernicious when you think about it, isn't it? The community sponsorship model. So the Sudanese community in this country...
And get more Sudanese in.
Sponsor Sudanese people.
I wonder if the Sudanese community have any incentive to get more Sudanese in.
Well, exactly. Right, and this is... something they talk about in here. Basically, what's going to happen is, look at this. Canada's community sponsorship scheme has successfully resettled 400,000 refugees since 1979. So that's a long time.
We could probably do that in a year.
Exactly, right? Mm. I would love to see the curve on this, because I bet it was very small, very small, very, whoa, what are you doing, right? But anyway, the point being is that what this is going to allow is for refugees to work. It's going to allow them to, they've removed the prohibition on illegal immigrants gaining citizenship, so they're going to get a path to citizenship, and it's going to make sure that they can actually become members of the community. But okay, but whose community? Because I'm not sponsoring any bloody refugees.
No.
You're not sponsoring any refugees.
I doubt it.
But who is going to sponsor refugees?
Yes.
Well, the Sudanese community, the Somali community, the Pakistani community, the Bangladeshi community, they're all going to be sponsoring it.
And they're not exactly short of aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews to work in their businesses that are currently operating before they change the name of them.
But they're going to use the Tory scheme, which was with the Ukrainian refugees specifically. The Tories said, we'll pay you £350 a month if you house a Ukrainian refugee. And we'll do it for up to 18 months. They're planning to pay the migrant communities to sponsor foreigners to come and live in their houses. So if you've got a cousin in Bangladesh or whatever,
who you wanted to bring over anyway,
the government will allow them in a safe and legal controlled way to apply as a refugee and then pay you to take your cousin.
Who you wanted to bring in anyway. You now get £350.
Madness. Absolute madness. And I love this. Shabana Mahmood has told Politics UK that asylum seekers will repay this country's generosity by paying back their asylum support. How's that going to happen? They'll be required to contribute towards the cost of their asylum using the welfare that we give them.
Oh, right. Okay.
So
this is plugging the Extension League lead back into itself.
Absolutely. We're going to give them money and they're going to be forced to pay £10,000 out of their benefits. I mean, literally, this will be means tested and paid monthly, either directly or taken from benefits. That's exactly what
they'll probably put their benefits up to cover it as well.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah. That's probably true. And they're paying £350 a month to their families to take them in. And so it's just like, right, okay. All right, nothing's going to change.
Fair point. Yeah. So even if it is, was it £350 a month, is it? Mm-hmm. So even if they take £350 a month out of their benefits.
Yeah.
The £350 instead goes to the person they're living with, who is their aunt, uncle, or cousin.
Yeah.
Right.
And we know that these people live many more to a household than we are prepared to, right? Mm. So if you've got four people in your household, you could possibly expect 10 in theirs. Mm. Okay, if that's, if the government's expecting four-person households and then suddenly has an extra six people in, it's paying, £350 per person. Oh, now you're incentivizing them because they're going to be making out like bandits. Yeah. And they don't care that they're going to force, little Jahid from the village to live in a bunk bed in a room with five other people. They don't care because the government's going to be paying them like £3,000. So, yeah. Or like £2,000. Great. That's just great. This is Starmer doing it. Right? This is under Starmer's government. It'll doubtless get worse under Burnham.
I mean, obviously, when we come to power, there's going to be a lot of deportations. I am willing to slow roll some of it because I want to go round to Shabana Mahmood's house, to Andy Burnham's house, to Keir Starmer's house and say, look, here's 40 Sudanese. They're going to be living in your house until we get around to deporting them.
The thing about all of this as well is assuming any of it can be proven, right? Mm. If, on paper, I've got five people living with me, so the government's paying me like, grand half.
Oh, it's like postal votes all over again.
Yeah, is anyone coming around to actually check that?
Yeah.
Because I might say to all my cousins in India, right, okay, guys, come over, and if that one person does come around to check, you can say, look, we're all living here, and then you can just go home, and I'll pay you £200 a month to just live in India. I'll collect 150 quid, and everyone gets what they wanted at the end of it, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone just, it's so open to abuse, and as if these schemes aren't just completely...
This is the problem with government, and especially Labour, is it never occurs to them that anything they do might be manipulated.
Yes. Anyway, so Stephen Swinford here from The Times thinks that it'll be... this was written on the 22nd of June, so probably about two and a half weeks now till we get Andy Burnham as the coronated Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Like I said, I don't think he's going to call an election. I don't think he needs to. I think he's the last chance the Labour Party have. I think a lot of them feel that he's the last chance.
He thinks that if he gets 3 years, he can win the public over, because at the moment he thinks that the machine will do what he says, because he's still in fantasy land.
Yeah, absolutely. And
every single Prime Minister, and Keir Starmer will do this as well, every Prime Minister we've had, after their Prime Minister, they start doing interviews where they say, I asked for things to be done and nothing happened.
I pulled levers and nothing happened. Yeah.
They all say it. Yeah.
So let's take a look at the polls. Mm. So, there has been a Burnham bump. It hasn't been that big.
Certainly not enough to call an election.
No, I wouldn't want to call an election with those numbers.
No.
If I was Nigel Farage or the Labour Party, frankly.
I mean, if I was at the Labour Party and I think like I do, I would. Because if I would get 21% now and remain a major party in opposition, that might be worth doing.
Mm. But this is interesting, isn't it? Dip for Reform, boost for Labour, but puts them on 21%. And that's how bad Labour's fortunes were, right? And all what it takes to get at least some people back on is for them to say, look, we're a Labour Party who doesn't hate you. That's all. Because Andy Burnham's entire shtick is, I'm on your side, I'm one of us, you know. And so that's drawn some people back. Conservatives stuck on 18%. Greens down by 2%. So Zach Polanski's on the decline now, and Lib Dems floating around 12-13% as usual.
Labour accept, because at least one in five people must work for the state, and that's going to draw a lot of the support. Conservatives I can understand, because, you know, still a lot of older pensions. Boomers. Yeah. Greens, that's invaders and wide-eyed student girls. Yeah. And Lib Dems, people who just don't want to think about this stuff, but they do have a nice garden. So
Yeah, but I mean, the Conservatives and Lib Dems basically on borrowed time.
Yeah, right?
The number of people getting nice gardens, the attrition rate for that, the churn rate for that, is going to be a slowly declining constituency.
Well, the Conservative one particularly is very predictable.
Yeah, and the Conservatives won't be around in 20 years.
No,
just in 20 years' time,
no, they won't.
All the boomers have had, you know, have passed on.
Yep.
There just won't be Conservative voters anymore. So that's that party cooked. Mm. So anyway. Here's another poll, something very similar. Restore at 6% on that one, though.
Hmm.
So that's a nice...
Did they prompt for that one? Or?
I don't know, actually. I didn't check, to be fair.
Right.
But it's Pinium. But let's assume they did after Makefield, which I think would be the charitable thing to do. As you can see, Restore on 6% is a good chunk suddenly in, you know. Half the Greens there, but the Greens, again, on the decline. Labour on 21, Reform on 26, Conservatives on 17. Fairly similar. And then another one from YouGov, Reform on 24, Labour on 20, Conservatives on 20, Lib Dems and Greens sliding down a bit. So you can see there has been a bit of a bump, probably coming from the Lib Dems and Greens, mostly Greens, I would suggest. But it's not that significant. And so going into the poll of the polls for June 26th, still not great for anyone, really. You know, Restore Britain up to 5 on average, which is pretty
good.
This
brings us back to the point I've been making all along on this series, is that our political system is not designed for 6 political parties.
No.
So something is going to shake out. But, I mean, as in trying to make predictions for the next election.
Oh, God, yeah.
Anyone's guess when you've got 6 parties in a 2-party system.
Yes. And especially when, like, the old hands in the 2-party system are desperately trying to save it. Mm. I mean, fair enough to Kemi Badenoch. Because, I mean, if you go back, say, a year, right, the Conservatives are on 17% on average, and she's managed to get them to 18%.
So and really, if Nigel Farage has been doing his job, he would have ground that down.
Yeah, she has actually stemmed the bleeding. She hasn't increased the share, but...
No. And of course, Farage blunted his key differentiator by hiring so many Tories.
Yes, and kicking out the right wing of his own party.
Yep.
This has been a mistake because, I mean, that 5% at the bottom there could have been 5% that Reform would have had, right?
Yep.
Like, why are they outside of you, Nigel? You know, you should have been like, no, these are my outriders. We're going to make me look like a moderate, and everything would have been groovy if I'd been able to do big tent politics.
Well, instead he did it the other way around. He embraced the Conservatives and attacked the right wing.
Yeah, and that didn't solve any problems. So BMG found that they polled in the 23rd and 24th June. It's like, if Andy Burnham was the Labour leader, so this is over a week ago now, right? If Andy Burnham was the Labour leader, how would you vote? And people are like, I'd vote for Labour over Reform, plus 5 to Labour, 27%. Yeah.
Yeah. Why isn't that not going to hold up?
Why isn't that shaken out then in the other polls? Why isn't that shaking out in the polar polls? Like this like is not something that is actually manifesting itself.
Mm.
And it's because Andy Burnham's net approval is already going down.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, he hasn't even got the job yet.
He hasn't even got the job. And he's not subject to a great media blitz either. The media is surprisingly positive about him.
And within a week of him getting on, and a week is generous, there will be some horrific attack. And he's going to have to find words to address, because at the moment he's just ignoring it. Like you said, he's just dancing around it. He's not acknowledging it. But there will be a horrific attack, and he will be expected to say something. And if he says nothing, he's going to lose. If he says something, he's going to upset somebody.
Yeah.
It's just nothing. There's nothing that he can do, or any other politician that's willing to play within this system can do.
Yeah, and no, that's completely true. And, I mean, he is still the most liked politician, but that's because I think he personally is quite a likable guy.
Well, and also he hasn't been in Westminster for more than a week.
Exactly, and he got to build up a nice reputation as the mayor of Manchester, yeah. Which means it's not really a partisan position. But already, and again, I need to stress, the political media in this country is overwhelmingly Blairite. Right? Sky, Telegraph.
Well, even the Daily Mail is, I mean.
The Spectator, edited by Gove. The Daily Mail, calling Restore Nazis.
Yes.
Like, they're all fundamentally comfortable with the Blairite settlement and want to play in that sandpit. Burnham has been given a really easy ride by this media, by any standards, because a lot of it really does want Tony Blair's Labour Party to be in charge. Because if you think of the age of the people who are editing this now, that's when they were coming up. Their formative years in politics and in the world were under Cool Britannia and Tony Blair's rictus grin of how things can only get better.
Well, and also the political power system in this country is a fully Blairite system. Completely. So therefore, they are the people that get to hand out perks and patronage. And therefore, if you are successful in this current world, the easiest way to have got there is to be in tune with the existing power structure, because it's just by far... You can do it a different way, but it's just a hell of a lot harder.
And those people who are like our age or older, who are looking back at this system, and in its defence, Britain had a great run between about 1995 and 2005, maybe even up to 2010. Right, we had a great run. Living standards were going up. Like the ability to buy houses was going up. The cultural confidence in the end of the 90s, of the year 2000, of Britain was Spice Girls and Oasis and all this. Like we never, not since the 60s and the Beatles, had we had this kind of cultural confidence and cultural impact.
Yeah, well, 90s golden age, definitely.
It genuinely was. And so for the people now running the country, and I mean, like, at every level, like, the politicians, like, literally, Andy Byrne was a Blairite minister. The people editing the Daily Mail or the Spectator or the Telegraph or whatever it is, for them, Burnham represents a return to nostalgia, right? He represents a safe golden age that he is promising to return to. So he's getting the most comfortable, like, it's literally like a water slide that's being greased for him to slide down into number 10. And everyone's like, oh my God, it's coronation. Yeah, you're all coronating him.
Mm.
Like, no one's going on the hard campaign against Andy Burnham. And even we're not doing that because it just doesn't seem worth it. It doesn't seem, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, I don't hate Andy Burnham. I don't think, I mean, like, Farage tried it in Makerfield, didn't work.
I just think he's the wrong target because it's not Andy Burnham, the personality. I just don't buy into this whole personality thing. It is the Blairite system that has been built up that can produce no other outcome than the outcome that it is currently producing.
And for some reason, more of the same is not something I expect to give yield a different result. But anyway, Burnham's favourability is going down. Not by a huge amount or anything like that, but his unfavourability is going
down. I mean, he isn't even in the job yet.
Yeah. And also, he was the mayor of Manchester, right? Mm. I mean, like, if we'd gone back 3 years and just gone out on the street and been like, have you ever heard of Andy Burnham? We'd be like, no.
Yeah, unless you're asking in Manchester.
Exactly. Unless you're asking in Manchester, why would you have heard of Andy Burnham?
Yeah, I mean,
unless you're a Labour Party apparatchik, why would you?
I mean, we remember him because we're political nerds enough to know who the junior ministers in Blair's government was.
Yeah.
And he was thoroughly there was a reason why he went to Manchester, because he was thoroughly uninspiring.
He kept
and
failing in his challenges for leadership.
Yes.
Because, as you say, completely uninspiring. But the point is, the more the public is becoming exposed to him, they get an unfavourable opinion because they don't think anything's going to change, right? Here's an opinion poll for The Observer. And this is just remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. So Andy Burnham's Hope and Glory campaign, and honestly, I don't think he could have run a better campaign in Makerfield, right? I don't think he could come out with a better pitch for, well, I mean, he could come out with a better pitch for the sort of moral direction of the country, but from his position as a Labour grandee,
yes,
it's as good as it could possibly have been.
But still only a third of Labour voters,
yeah,
think that things are going to get better.
Yeah. Two-thirds of them are like, it's going to stay the same or get worse.
Half of that for all adults.
Yeah. And yeah, for when it comes to like all adults, only 17% of the country are going on this journey with him.
Yes.
Like not even a not even the 21% who intend to vote Labour think that this is going to get better, right?
But clearly things are going to get worse because nothing will change except the debt will go up.
Well, I like the British public's wisdom. It's going to stay about the same, as in things are going to crap. No light at the end of the tunnel and things will just get worse. I think it will get worse, actually, because he's going to raise taxes. He's going to ignore immigration. He'll mess up in ways.
The thing is, he's going to try and do what Keir Starmer had finally learnt was impossible, which was try and change things.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's true. But yeah, so basically half the public are like, this isn't going to work. Isn't going to fix anything. Nothing's going to get better. It's probably going to get worse. And as you said, pointing at Andy Burnham and be like, oh, I hate Andy Burnham personally. Who cares?
No.
It's just a suit. Well, he's not even a suit, actually. He's wearing his bloody black shirt, black t-shirt and a jacket and his eyelashes. And it's just like, that's all we hear. And it's like, okay, but the British public isn't being fooled by this. And they're not being won over by it. And they might personally think Andy Burnham's all right, but then nothing's going to change. So that's what's happening on the left at the moment. So the last great white hope for the Labour Party is Andy Burnham, and he's already lost the confidence of the voters. On the right,
oh, yeah,
things are going weird, man. So we had the other day the storm in the teacup that was Rupert Lowe was like, I'm fine with multiculturalism if they integrate, which obviously he means, you know, multiracialism, but that caused a massive furore in the online right.
It did, yeah.
Because, oh, Rupert Lowe's not like a Wignat. It's like, yeah, duh, obviously he's not a Wignat. He never said he was.
Yes.
He didn't say he was going to purge every non-white person in the country. What did you think he was saying? Why did you think he was saying that? You know. No. But that like little story.
Rupert Lowe is not Steve Laws.
Yeah, it was the shocking lesson
yes.
that the online Wignats learned the other day. And they were like, oh, it's over. It's like, what did you think?
But counterpoint, look at his policy. I mean, he's putting bloody India and Pakistan on a red list.
Yes.
I mean, just look at the actual policy. Yes, he doesn't go as far as Steve Laws.
That's still pretty
good. He goes substantially further than everybody else.
Absolutely. So that storm in the teacup passed very quickly. Like friends,
well, it was a bit confected, but
it was. But it was. It's also a sort of sign of the sort of ideological purism. Like a lot of the communists, like, I've seen communists say the same thing about Keir Starmer leading the Labour Party. So yeah, but look what he's doing. He's getting you a lot closer to communism than anyone else outside.
Well, I mean, there were a few people that we're friendly with who got involved in that restore. Brief furore. And I just said, look, you're just going to have to settle for getting 90% of what you want in the first parliament.
Yep.
And if 90% in the first go is not good enough for you, then be a beautiful loser.
Yeah, but that's what online ideological discourse is. It makes beautiful losers, and it's not productive. And it honestly, it's like, okay, you kind of want to. I mean, this is the famous thing about Tony Blair. He always said no to his left. He just, you know, with his radicals on his left, they were like, we're demanding, and Tony, no, we're not doing that.
But crucially, he didn't make the mistake that both Keir Starmer and Nigel Farage made, which is he said no to them. He didn't exclude them.
Yes, he didn't expel
them. They were always welcome, but he just said no to them.
Yeah, here's the agenda. This is what we're doing. We're not doing that.
Yes.
You can carry on thinking what you want, but this is what we're doing. And that's the sensible thing that Rupert Lowe has been doing. He's not been excluding them. He's not turned on them. He's not purged them. You know, he didn't kick Steve Laws out. He doesn't disavow him. He's just like, no, I'm not. I
remember an interview with Tony Blair when Corbyn came to power, and Blair recited a number of times when he was prime minister, where he met with Corbyn, and he was perfectly civil to them, and he just disagreed with him. Yep. But it didn't occur to him to kick him out of the party.
Yes.
And as a result, you did not get the formation of the Green Party when Tony Blair was in charge. That has happened now under Starmer, and Restore has happened under Farage, because they think that you can't just say no to people. You have to excommunicate them.
But also, like, Tony Blair understood you need the Big Tent coalition, right? Like I said, Restore now on the polls at 5%, Farage down to 25%. Well, that's not your majority. 30% plus, that might be a majority. Yep. You've actually harmed yourself by being cruel to the radicals.
The one thing that does annoy me is some people who say, oh, look, and the logic for the big tent is absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And then they go on for that, like Rafe at the policy or policy exchange.
New Culture Forum.
New Culture Forum, yeah. And he was saying, look, you know, Restore have got to come all in on a big tent. And it's like, but it's literally impossible because they were deliberately thrown out. They were pushed out. It's not on them.
Farage would have to apologise to Rupert Lowe publicly. Right?
Yes.
For anyone who's wondering how this would have to happen, he would have to come out and give a big mea culpa and say, look, that was a mistake I made. I allowed Zia Yusuf to do this. I made the mistake and I'm sorry. Rupert Lowe, I would love to make amends. Please can we go for dinner so I can apologise to you personally. Mm. I'd like to apologise to all of the Restore supporters who also felt slighted by the way I'd behaved. I wasn't right to do it. And actually, I really want to make amends so for the sake of the country, we can save Britain.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone that we kicked out, we would like to bring back in. We would like you to come back into the fold and I will make Rupert Lowe whatever, you know, give him a spokesman position for, you know, Reform's deportation policy.
I mean, at this point, it would have to be a very senior one as well.
It would.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially given the sort of clout Rupert Lowe, the political capital Rupert Lowe has generated. Like, Farage would have to humble himself to the point where it's never going to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, what you've just described is impossible for any politician to do.
Well, I mean, I don't think it would be impossible for any politician. It's just it's definitely impossible for Farage.
I can't remember ever seeing a politician anywhere in the Western world doing what you've just described.
No, but
maybe somebody can think of an example.
But I really think it would raise Farage's profile and star, right? I actually, because after Makerfield, he came out and gave a bit of a mea culpa. Mm. And actually, I think everyone thought better of him for it, right? He was like, Restore people, what do you want? You know, like there was some sort of outreach there, and he came out and was like, yeah, no, we thought we were going to win, but we didn't, and that was our fault. And it's like, okay, that's better than just being like belligerent partisan politician, right? So it's not that it couldn't happen, and actually it's a very good thing when it does, but there's no way Farage is going to do this, right? So anyway, in Reform, it's been a bit like a pressure cooker, and Dr. David Bull, the former chair of Reform, who stepped down in May because the stress of everything, apparently, he wanted to take some time off, has come out and said Nigel Farage should take a break from politics. Now, he said, quote, Reform, the party, is way bigger than Nigel. Politics is ruthless business. I think also one of the other things I would say to Farage as a friend and colleague is that he needs to take some time out and have a bit of a break, really.
Well, I mean, that was what we were saying last week. I mean, one of the points we made is when he was doing all that head in the hand stuff every time he was having an interview, is he's such a different guy from a couple of years ago. So a couple of years ago, he was having fun. You'd see him with a pint in his hand, laugh, and it was a proper laugh as well. You could tell he was enjoying himself, and he just feels really, really stressed at the moment.
Yeah.
And look, obviously building a political party is a big stressful job. Well, I say stressful, but it's very, very challenging.
Yes.
But if you're loving what, I mean, working here sometimes can be like that.
Sure.
We're banging out stuff. I mean, quite often I film three times a day and you just get little breaks in between and you're researching and you're doing stuff.
And a lot of the stuff you're covering is harrowing.
Yeah, but I don't ever come away, and the guys in Restore, they're not like holding their heads in, they're not upset
the
about
warriors.
It. Yes.
Happy warriors.
Yes.
And we all are, by the way, you know, you should see our group chats. One day they'll probably get leaked. but the point is, we're happy warriors, whereas Reform don't feel like happy warriors.
No, they feel embittered.
Yes, and I think it genuinely comes from what Farage and Zia did to Rupert. And because this schism is it's a much more stressful thing for Reform than it is for anyone else.
But where I'm going with that is that I worked in loads of organisations, loads of teams, loads of small growing businesses who've been doing stuff. If everybody is aligned, it doesn't really matter how hard the work is. You actually still enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's when there are internal tensions within the organisation and you're trying to do something. I mean, if there's internal tensions and you're not trying to do anything, well, that's just the public sector. That's the local council. But if you're trying to do something and you're at loggerheads, that is an absolute hellscape to work in. And it sounds like that's happening here.
He who has a why can bear any how.
Yes. Right?
That's exactly what it comes down to. And exactly. Like, Farage has made his bed here. Right, he's the one who did this to himself, and of course, this comes hot on the heels of everyone going after him for this £5 million donation by Christopher Harborne.
I don't actually care about that.
No, I don't care about that at all.
No,
like, yeah, okay, you know, I can understand some insanely wealthy man who wanted Brexit, wanting to reward Farage for giving Brexit,
and I actually think that he should be rewarded for Brexit.
Yeah,
if it was up to me. I would give him a knighthood and build a bloody statue of him in Westminster Square, because I still appreciate what he did for Brexit.
Same here.
He absolutely should be rewarded and acknowledged and become a historic figure for it. Yep. I just don't think that I agree with Elon Musk. He hasn't got what he takes.
Yeah, and that's the frustration. And just to be clear, I don't hate Nigel Farage. I'm frustrated with Nigel Farage. I'm frustrated that you aren't the thing you need to be. And I've said this before.
Yeah.
You need to step into a new mold now, Nigel. The conciliatory, like, returning king, and you're not doing it.
And if he flipped into elder statesman mode, you know, I'd be all for him.
Yeah, and
because he could do that.
Yeah, like, retire and be like do your GB News show, give your sort of, and it's not that he doesn't have intelligent and wise things to impart, it's just he's made a hash of this. He's made an absolute mess of it, and it's not good. And so, like I said, I don't care about the money at all. And I, if I were the Conservatives, after Brexit, they should have just made him a Conservative Lord.
Yes.
Like, wind up the Brexit Party, we make you a Lord in the House of Lords, so you can go and make money as you see fit, you know, you can just live a happy life and be pressure on the backbenches, or not the backbenches, the House of Lords, when you want to be. You know, when you feel like coming out and, you know, giving us a bit of a tongue lashing for not doing Brexit right or whatever, you can come out and do that because you're within our tent and we would have been secure. You know, but they didn't because they were stupid, and he didn't because he was stupid with Rupert Lowe. And it's like, if the lesson has to be learned, you can't just break off your radical flank and expect it not to come back and bite you in the arse.
Yeah, whether you're Keir Starmer or Nigel Farage.
Whether you're Starmer, whether you're the Conservatives, whether you're Farage. You are dragged forward by your radical flank.
Well, yeah, actually, you're right, because you could look at it that the Conservatives did exactly the same thing. But they didn't quite expel their Brexit right, but they kind of did.
For a long time, David Cameron and the Remainer faction kept control of it. And it was only afterwards that Boris Johnson actually got in with the Brexiteer faction.
Yes.
And Farage recognised it and was like, okay, stand down then.
Back at that time, I knew several people who were still currently serving ministers.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about several people here. Every one of them was a lifelong Brexiteer, lifelong anti-EU.
Yeah.
Every single one of them signed up to the Remain campaign because Cameron, well, his acolytes went around to all of them and said, look, you won't have a career unless you back Remain.
Yeah.
And so they all flipped.
Yeah. I know a bunch of people who are close to the Boris faction who were Brexiteers, and they won, so good for them. You know, they still lost their careers, so that wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
But they were like the decent people in the Tories who were like, no, that is what we should be doing, right? Mm. And really, again, the Tories should have just taken Farage in then. Like, no, we're trying to get Nigel Farage.
They probably should have done it 20 years ago.
Well, yeah. But
to be fair,
it was more obvious.
Farage tells a story. I mean, like I said, I had dinner with him years ago, and he tells a story about how he was offered a senior position under. Might have even been pre-Cameron. It was around about that time. He was offered a senior position and he turned it down. I don't know how true that is, but...
Well, I mean, it might have been true. Yeah. But he's in a position now that's too commanding, right?
Yeah.
And in 2019, he was in a commanding position. Like, you know, Nigel Farage was Mr. Brexit, according to Trump. So The Tories should have recognised that rather than pushing him out. And now, look where he is, because they rejected their radical flank. And look where he is, now he's rejecting his radical flank. There's just no room to reject your radical flank. You just have to tolerate them. And in many ways, the radical flank is insufferable. Like, we have to see the Wignats on Twitter whining at us constantly, like, what, you don't think that 100% is, whatever, you know, calm down. You know, calm down. You know, but you can't.
If somebody's a quarter, whatever, a quarter French, you're going to evict them. It's like, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, exactly. But we recognize they are a part of what our political mission is.
Mm.
And Farage refused to accept that. And so now he's in a position where David Bull, one of his most long-time and loyal compadres, is like, you need to relax, mate. You need a break. You need a break.
You can see it from the public appearances. The guy's frazzled.
Yeah. Yeah. And this means that there's a general schism in the party. Now, don't worry about the headline here, because the lead is very fully buried at the bottom here. But this is the interesting bit. So this is Sebastian Payne writing in the Times. Here we go. So there's a schism in the party about its direction. Some notably, its Home Affairs spokesman, Zia Youssef, want to embrace the paranoid style, as identified by the political scientist Richard Hofstadter, when examining Barry Goldwater in the 1964 US presidential election, a conspiratorial worldview that finds enemies everywhere. You can see this in Youssef's attacks on the media, branding his rivals as traitors, and this constant war with the amorphous establishment, whoever is in it. There's a reason that some in Reform think Youssef is a menace, as one senior councillor described him, and think his acolytes need to be contained, even banished from the party. Now, I think that's a really uncharitable view of Zia Youssef. And I didn't think I'd be here mounting a massive defence of Zia Youssef.
Well, to be fair, Zia Youssef is the only one that I actually particularly like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm at the point now, when I look at Reform, that Zia Youssef is the person I most identify with.
Yes.
Because he's clearly the
apart
right...
Apart from being Schlanken, yes.
But, yeah. But he's the right of Reform.
Yes.
He's found himself standing alone on the right after dealing with a political enemy to his right.
And the thing is, once you start doing this process of, we're just going to chop everybody on the right, well, okay, now Zia Youssef is the guy on the right. And if they chop him... Well, then it'd be Suella Braverman is and then we chop her.
Let's put a pin in that because we're going to come back to
In
a second, right? So Zia Youssef now represents the right. Now, I think calling it the paranoid style, again, this is not fair because, like, his attacks on the media, his branding his rivals as traitors, and, like, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party and all that, and his constant war with the amorphous establishment, I endorse all of that. He's right.
All I hear... is Zia doesn't want to toady up to people like Sebastian Payne. But also, Sebastian Payne doesn't like that.
But also, Zia Youssef is against the Blairite system. That's what I hear. The media are the problem, the academics, the intellectuals are the problem, and the system itself is the problem. And Zia Youssef has recognised this. And I forgot to get this clip, but he was on like LBC or something. He said, look, I actually understand the desire to join Restore and throw the biggest firebomb you can at the establishment. I understand that. And he was actually very empathetic to the Restore position because it's what's necessary. And so this is why he's like, yeah, no, attack the media, attack the Labour Party as traitors, constant war with the establishment. He's right. That's the correct position. The Trumpian position. No, I'm at war with all of this. And I want to flip the public to my position because the system's killing them. Right.
Yep.
That's perfectly reasonable. On the other side of that, you now have the Reform left, which are the Tories. Another faction within Reform argues for a less rebarbative, more reasoned approach. Danny Kruger. These folks are the former Conservatives who Youssef openly loathes. Weirdly, I'm totally on Youssef's side here, right?
Yep.
They argue privately that the use of racial politics was unnecessary. Was necessary to seal Rupert Lowe's Restore Party, but the party ultimately needs to appeal to the centre to have any chance of winning. And of course, you find Robert Jemrick, Danny Kruger on this side of things, along with Lalia Cunningham. Farage is straddling both sides, sometimes coming across as more rational and traditional in his arguments, at other times he indulges in the paranoid style, seen as a response to legitimate questions about the £5 million donation. But the uneasy internal truce is breaking down. Reform has done very well so far thanks to a leader who outstrips the party's popularity and despite its growth, has kept a lid on factionalism. Now, both of those fundamentals are under threat. I think that's correct as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're keeping a lid of factionalism through a leader. I mean, in the same way that Alexander the Great did. But what happens the moment when Alexander is no longer around?
Yes. And so David Bull being like, you're burnt out. I can see you're burnt out. You need to take
a break. Oh, we can see he's burnt out.
Yeah, everyone can see he's burnt out. But you need to take a break, which is good advice on a personal level. But what happens with the party But Nigel Farage goes off for a month, and everyone's like, oh, right, the top spot seems to be up for grabs.
Yeah.
Right? If there's a vacuum, a power vacuum.
And at one time, Zaya would have filled that role.
Very comfortably.
But now, because Danny Kruger has now got some more Tory allies, that's a big counterweight. And you can just see the factionalisations fighting each other constantly and if Farage isn't there to tap it all down.
And ironically, Zia Youssef would have been leaning on Rupert Lowe and us to counterbalance them if he hadn't backstabbed Rupert Lowe. So, like, this sort of, like, you know... act in haste and repent at leisure. Well, now you're repenting at leisure.
Well, I'd love to find out one day, and I'm probably going to have to wait for Zaya Youssef's memoirs, why did he get in on the axing of Lowe?
Well, he didn't. He was already in before. He paid 200 grand. And
No. Why did Zaya...
Oh, why did he was participate?
The point man
on
getting rid of Lowe.
Well, I guess at the time, because there weren't that many Conservatives in the party, were there, at the time?
Yeah.
All the Tories hadn't joined. Mm. So I guess it was just looking at, there's a lot of... The space on the right feels quite squeezed. If I get rid of the right-wing guy, I become the right-wing. I occupy this entire space.
Maybe.
Right? But then a bunch of Conservatives brought in and said, like, oh, no, now we need some allies on the right. Well, oh, no, what happened to my allies, right?
Yeah.
Who knows? Dan Hodges says something very similar. This is probably behind a paywall. Oh, no, I've got the... Oh, there we go. Right, okay. So Dan Hodges says something similar because he's speaking to people in Westminster. And they talk about whether the physical demands of leading the party virtually single-handedly are starting to catch up with the grandfather of British populism. I don't know if I've got it up there. Where it's in here somewhere, right? I've got it out. Anyway, right, I'll read it off my notes. One pointed to the way he had twice cancelled in quick succession planned appearances on BBC's flagship Laura Kusenberg show. That's a big audience, and usually he revels in those outings. Missing one is fine, but two, that's not like him. According to reports, Farage has told allies he wants to take a break from working at weekends. As one friend told me, he's been working flat out for 2 years, the general election through to the local elections. He's earned a bit of downtime, which is, of course, the view covered by David Bull, which is not wrong, but the problem...
This is unsustainable, because
let's
say he's working flat out and he's working weekends, and then he actually wins the election. What's he going to do, take a holiday then? No.
Yeah. When do you get your holiday, Nigel?
Yes.
The answer is never. So anyway, let's carry on, right? So he's also reported to have spent time visiting his close confidant George Cottrell, who's based in Montenegro, and according to his friend, he is not solely focusing on his party when he meets wealthy financiers. Nigel understands politics is precarious. He has to think of his future and his family's future.
I was about to make a money thing.
Yes. Dan Hodges also says he's told the experience of walking into Trump's Mar-a-Lago beach club and being feted by the leader of the free world is up there with the greatest moments of Nigel Farage's life, but that alliance is drawing to a close. There's already been a bit of distancing, one Farage ally reveals, and Nigel knows that the relationship is not going to be there for much longer. Trump is going to be gone before the next election. He won't have that to lean on anymore, as in Trump's time in office will expire before the 2029 elections, because it's planned 2028. So, and even then, as we've been talking about previously, Trump has very clearly distanced himself from Farage. Very clearly.
And I don't see Marco Rubio or Vance, you know, bridging that gap either.
I mean, if Farage were to win a general election and become Prime Minister, I'm sure Rubio or Vance would.
They'd have some sort of communication with him, but then they're not...
Oh, I think they'd be tighter than you think, but it's still not Trump calling him Mr. Brexit, you know, when he was all tanned on...
He's not going to go back to the fated thing.
No, exactly. You know, and that is an emotional issue, he thinks, for Farage. And anyway, so they've gone on with the professionalisation, which the professionalisation project has apparently stalled. A few months ago, everyone conceded that everything was too centralised around Nigel and he's up for changing that, but nothing's happened. There's drift. Zia is fighting for control, others are fighting for control, but no one's in charge. So there was talk of Nigel appointing a new chief of staff, but that's run in sand. And so you get this power struggle in the party. And so this happened on BBC Question Time, and it was...
Can I just very quickly say, wrapping up on that last point, there is only one way to grow a large organisation very rapidly, and that is to constantly, and I do mean constantly, push every decision down to the lowest level where that decision can be made. Yeah. Yeah, and if you ever see a decision being made at a level where it could be made at a low, at a lower level, aggressively push that down and make sure decisions are made at the lowest level possible. Yeah. Fundamentally, the opposite of the strategy Farage has pursued as we've ever seen, which is to bring every decision up to the top. It just you don't have the bandwidth.
You can run a
small organization that way, but it will just crash and burn if you try and do that on a large scale.
You don't have the bandwidth. You're just one man. Yeah. Anyway, so coming back to that pin with Zia Youssef and the power struggle in reform, this is what you said on Question Time the other day.
Can I just say, Zia, one thing that never ceases to amaze me is you talk about government, how easy it is to run government. You've never stood for Parliament. You know, Andy Burton, to be fair to him, and you criticise many of the things he's done and said, but at least he's been willing to put his head above the parapet. Why have you not done that? Why have you not stood in some of the by-elections, the opportunities you've had around the country to get elected?
Hold on. What makes you think I never put myself above the parapet and wanted to stand in a by-election, Kevin?
Well, you haven't done that, have you?
What makes you think that?
Because you haven't stood, Zia.
Anybody who wants to stand in a by-election automatically gets to do so. Maybe in the Conservative Party, where it's just cronyism and nothing else matters, mate. But I think you made a lot of very big assumptions.
Okay, so that's interesting. Right. So have you put your name forward to stand in by-elections?
We have an application process to stand in parliamentary by-elections. And all I'd say is that coming after me for not being willing to stand in a parliamentary by-election is incorrect and hugely presumptuous.
What did they do? Why did they stop?
Did they refuse you?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
That is not the political answer.
No. That is the answer of, I'm in a faction that's being marginalised,
yes,
and the Tories in my party have marginalised. Because we assumed Zia Youssef was just being clever, because we assumed Zia Youssef had a level of power and influence, and we spoke about this a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah, and didn't want to dilute it. Whereas basically what he said there is they picked that idiot Matt GPT instead.
Yes. Yeah, they picked Matt GPT, they picked Robert Kenyon,
yeah.
They didn't pick me. And like you said, that's not the political answer. Coming out on Question Time and being like, I'm being sidelined in my own party for some reason. That's a hell of an admission. Hell of an admission. It's virtually an attack on the Tories in reform. Just like, and again, I'm actually very sympathetic to Zia here. Actually, just through seniority alone, he should get the first pick, surely, you know? And it's not like he's an incompetent speaker in public or anything like that. He handled himself fine on Question Time, and he has done multiple times. So it's not like he can't be relied upon to...
Pretty sure he would have done better than Matt GPT as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, will Farage be PM? Well, as we talked about a while ago when he had his head in his hands, it's not looking great. But, of course, when Robert Jemrick is asked about this on Sky News, oh, absolutely, absolutely. Even though Farage himself been like, well, someone better might come along. I don't know. I can't say yet. It's like, weird stuff. But I think Farage is getting burnt out and there's a power struggle going on. And it's, Zia Youssef is losing it, actually.
Yep.
So, anyway, I think we are actually at a moment where things are changing, right? The Labour Party is on its last legs. It doesn't look like it's on its last legs if you look at the media narrative. So Andy Burnham's going to save us. But we all know that...
The thing that worries me most is that when you say things are changing, is the argument could be interpreted and say explicitly this is what you meant. But things could be changing back to how they were. Because what you've basically just described is how... reform is basically shape-shifting back into the Conservative Party.
Kind of. Okay, so on the left, I actually think that Labour is running out of track, right? I think that the narrative that is keeping Andy Burnham afloat is going to intersect with reality very soon. And I think he's just...
Always the biggest problem for the socialists.
And I think he's just going to crater, right?
Yes.
He's going to try doing a bunch of things that don't substantively change anything. Things will get worse. There'll be more foreigners. We will have to pay more money. Cost of living will go up. Everyone will be like, why are these murders happening on the streets, Andy? And we'll have no answers for any of them.
Right? No.
And no one else in the Labour Party will have the political capital to come forward and say, I could fix it. He's, I think, probably their last chance. And I mean, maybe Ed Miliband or someone, or, sure, you know... But I think...
And on the right-hand side of politics?
On the right-hand side of politics, the Conservative Party have made no ground whatsoever. right? And I don't think they're going to make any ground.
But they have done well to hold on.
They've held.
Yes.
Well, I think they've held because the boomers are like, ah, finally, the black woman who won't be called racist and tell it like it is.
Oh, they really do think that, yeah.
But they're on a ticking clock.
Yes.
The share is just decreasing every day. And so reform are going to fall into a civil war, if they're not already in hot civil war, in their own party. I mean, this...
Sounds a lot like a cold civil war is going on at the moment.
Yeah, but this feels like the first shot across the bows.
Yes.
Actually, from Zia, where it's like there's been a lot of positioning, like you say, a cold war going on in reform, but this feels like a first shot. No, I was blocked from standing somewhere. So why would you be blocked? You're literally the co-owner of the company that is reform. If they can block you, like... who knows what's going on? And this feels like the opening shot of the actual hot civil war and reform. Mm. Especially if Nigel Farage is like, look, I just need to take a couple of months off. I just need to go to a retreat, enjoy my £5 million, and, you know, drink some cocktails
don't,
on a
beach. Don't you guys fight while I'm away?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So it honestly could be going into meltdown, especially as the polls are not exactly glowing for anyone, really. So if they go into a public meltdown...
Creep
down in the polls.
The public hate that when they see
absolutely. That. No one thinks anything's going to get any better. People aren't really excited for a general election. And, I mean, Restore is slowly ticking up, so that's good. But basically, it looks like meltdown on the right and on the left. And so I don't know what comes after this, but I do think we're arriving at this point where there's kind of like an irrevocable change.
There is another potential way of looking at it, which is to go back to my sort of analogy of the machine.
Yeah.
Labour will not be able to get a different result from the machine than the machine is willing to give.
Yeah.
And the party of the right will ultimately end up resembling what the Conservatives are, because that is what the machine requires the party on the right to be. And you could almost follow reform as basically it's being forced to become ever more Tory-ish in order to comply with the machine. Which again leads me back to my earlier stuff that we were talking about on the show, where I said, ultimately, I think it's going to come down to Restore and the Greens, because they're the only two parties that are willing to break the machine. Yeah. The Greens will break it from the left, and Restore will break it from the right. Yeah. But you've now got Labour, the Tories, and it looks like increasingly the Tories, especially if they ditch Zia Yusuf, where you've basically got three main parties that are trying to operate on the machine without breaking it first.
Yes. So I think your prediction that it'll be Greens versus Restore eventually is going to come to pass. But the point is, I think we're passing a point of no return, right? Mm. I think what's happening is it's going to be, like Andy Burnham, I think, will make it patently obvious that the controlled opposition in the Tories isn't going to work. The Labour Party, as the sincere believers in the system, won't work. Mm. And so essentially, the Blairite consensus, like I said, it is running out of track. And, I mean, maniacs on either side can carry on laying track to get ahead. But the only promise there is revolution, basically.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, how surprising is it that this machine, which has got, you know, the Blair engine written on the side, only ever produces Blairite results?
Yes.
I mean, of course it does.
Yeah, and so anything that's not prepared to be off the track of Blairism and prepared to lay its own track is just going to have a meltdown in public, in the centre. Mm. And I think that's what's going to happen in the near future.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.